We're returning now to the horrific death of Aisling Murphy. Her violent murder has raised major discussion around the country about women's experience of violence and abuse by men. I'm joined now by Anne Clark, manager of Offaly Domestic Violence Support Services and a board member of Safe Ireland, by Sarah Grace, a sexual violence assault survivor and solicitor, and Dr. Caroline West, sex educator and host of the Glow West podcast. You're all very welcome to the programme. Anne, we might start with you because you're based in Offaly, and to share with us how, in your experience in Offaly, how this has resonated around the county.
Good morning, Pat. And first, we'd like to extend our deepest sympathy to Aisling Murphy's family. I suppose the community was in deep shock yesterday morning, and when the news broke the evening before. We're just numb, really. There's a sense of heaviness in the community that something like this could happen. And also, so poignant, so close to where Fiona Pender's memorial bridge is also within down that area of the canal where the assault took and murder took place. So, yeah, it's really sense of heaviness in the community this morning. And then as we hear that the person was released and is no longer subject to inquiry, that's kind of been replaced by a lot of apprehension and fear.
I suppose, though, it's different in your work in the sense that rather than random attacks, you are dealing with the victims of violence at the hands of people they know.
Absolutely. But I suppose we were thinking about that yesterday. And, you know, where this could be seen as a random attack, violence isn't random. And we have been relentless over the last 20 months, in particular during COVID. The level of violence in the community is very, very alarming. It's increasing every day. There are some days our staff go home hoping that the women that they're supporting will be alive over the weekend and they'll be able to talk to them again on Monday. We would have had women who are threatened with guns, knives, farming machinery, threats to kill, you know, threats to kill the whole family. And these are not one-off single random incidences that happen every day or you know, different times. It's actually every single day women are disclosing this level of threatening violence in the community and they're experiencing it. So I think the level of violence is there, but this kind of attack is quite rare.
Now, we're talking about how we might change things, but you've been in operation in your centre for, what, 25 years. Have things changed? Have things improved at all? Or are things worsening?
I think the level of violence is getting worse. And we're firefighting all the time because we are, you know, as you said, we actually marked 25 years in January. The service was founded by a volunteer who had actually lost her daughter to domestic violence. And, you know, it's shocking to think that on our 25th year, we lose a young life such as Aisling, so young, starting off in her career on within that same period as this service was open. I don't know if things are getting better. We're trying hard. We have better services now. We're able to offer more to women. But what we really need is to be properly resourced. You know, we need a national service development plan so that it's not a postcode lottery for where you live. So if you live in Galway, that service can provide only so much. If you live in Kilkenny, you might get something there. We need a complete cohesiveness of services around the country. And, you know, the 39 services of Safe Ireland, we have worked so closely during COVID as a collective to identify the various different barriers that have been presenting and to really call on the powers that be to address this perpetration of violence within our community and to look at having a designated junior minister to look at all the different departments coming together with a cohort response. So, you know, unless that happens, we are going to be 25 years on, probably having the same conversation.
Sarah Grace is also listening to that conversation. Sarah, you were a victim of violence in your own home, but not at the hands of a partner.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show, Pat. And I just want to echo my sympathies to Aisling's family. I'm just heartbroken for them, the whole nation is. But yeah, that's right. So I was attacked in my own home by a complete stranger, a burglar in the middle of the night. And I think just this tragedy that's happened to Aisling shows that, you know, women are not safe. We're not safe in our own homes, and we're not safe in crowded parks in the middle of the day. And it's a massive problem, and things just are not changing. These stories keep happening. The conversations are getting louder, and just change is not happening, or certainly not fast enough.
Do you have, after your terrible experience, and your perpetrator was caught and jailed, but do you have any understanding of why this is happening? I don't know whether it's more prevalent, but the attitudes of men, maybe with the access to pornography and so on, towards women seem to, in certain quarters at any way, be more demeaning than it would have been my experience growing up.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I can't tell you where it's coming from. I think certainly through internet, it's becoming more prevalent, or at least more visible, and we're starting to call it out more. But the one thing I will say is, when something as tragic as this happens, there is a tendency towards male bashing and accusing men. And it's true that violence against women is primarily, you know, carried out by men. It's a pandemic. But what I'm worried about is when we start to get too accusatory and to start blaming men across the board, there's a risk that we're alienating men from the conversation. And actually, we need their voice. We need them to start stepping up and talking about this. You know, like these things that happen in my case, or in Aisling's case, were carried out, they're just a senseless act carried out by just horrible people. But we have a lot of good men out there as well, and this is your battle too. This is your world. These are your sisters, your daughters, your friends. You know, we need you to start being an active ally. I know your heart's in the right place, but we need you to be more vocal and more visible in your support.
Lots in prospect with sport at the weekend, but before we talk about that, what might not be in prospect would be Novak Djokovic taking to the courts in the Australian Tennis Open. Kieran Simpson, producer with the Project TV show in Melbourne, has the latest. Is it all over, Kieran?
It's not quite over yet. While Novak Djokovic has had his visa cancelled for a second time, he can still appeal this decision, and it will go back through to the courts. However, he will be held in detention until that case can be heard, which is probably likely over the weekend, because obviously the Australian Open starts on Monday. There is a small glimmer of hope for him that if that isn't heard over the weekend, he could get his appeal and kind of be released on bail, so he could play in the Australian Open. But whether or not he'll make it to the end of the Australian Open is another matter.
Mm-hmm. So where is he incarcerated? Is he back in that grubby hotel?
We don't know yet. He hasn't yet been arrested by the Australian Federal Police as yet. He will be at some stage in the coming hours or in the morning once they find him and arrest him. So it is likely he would go back to the Park Hotel, which is the refugee hotel that he stayed in previously, which, as you know, the meals looked incredible. You can't open the windows and you can't leave your room. So it's going to be a tough couple of days for Novak Djokovic again.
Okay, but the smart money would suggest he will not be playing and his fellow Serb will get a walkover in the first round. Kieran, thank you very much for that update. Owen Sheehan from Off the Ball is listening in studio. Owen, good morning.
Good morning, Pat.
John Duggan was predicting he would not play, and at the moment it looks like John has been vindicated.
It does, and this thing is going to continue to develop even over the course of the next little while. As you've heard there, it is the direction hearing that is underway now. Djokovic's lawyers pushing for what will essentially be an expedited hearing over the course of the weekend. It could go in front of the same judge who, I guess, ruled in Djokovic's favour earlier in the week. It'll certainly be in front of the same court, so that might give the Djokovic team some glimpse of hope. But really, it seems that Mr. Hawk has acted on his own, and he's got every right to do so under Australian law, and his decision will more than likely be upheld. But wouldn't it be quite something if he was released on bail to play and essentially got deported with the Australian trophy in his arms? That would be quite something in all of this if he managed to somehow delay this thing for a fortnight.
Well, now we're going to talk about COVID, Omicron and hospitals with Anne O'Connor, Chief Operations Officer with the HSE. Anne, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat.
Now, let's talk numbers first of all. How many people in hospital who are confirmed COVID cases?
This morning, Pat, we have 1,023. So yesterday morning, that was 1,011. And of that, 92 are in ICU. So still a very high number across all of our hospital sites at the minute. Mm.
Now, yesterday during the press conference, there was an indication of how many of these cases were incidental. In other words, they went in for A and it turned out they had B as well, B being the COVID virus. So of the 1,123, how many of those are incidentally discovered?
I think what we work off, Pat, is in broad brush strokes, about 70% of the people who are in there, in that number, are people who came to hospital because COVID or a COVID-related illness was their primary cause for presentation. So they are people who are coming in for treatment for an illness due to COVID. And the other 30% are people who have gone in potentially, for example, with a broken leg or something, and they happen to also have COVID. So it's that type of split. And that has been the case, really, for the past week or so.
Now, the problem, as Paul Reid indicated, is that just because you're not particularly sick with COVID, just because you're asymptomatic and you have your broken leg, it doesn't mean you can be treated just like you have a broken leg. All the precautions have got to apply to that incidental COVID patient as well.
Yeah, and I think, to be honest, from our perspective, Pat, it doesn't really make a whole lot of difference, in the sense that, in terms of running our health system, once you have that number of people who are COVID positive in hospital, regardless, they have to be treated. So they are potentially infectious, and all of the infection control pathways that we have to have in place at the minute are really having a huge impact on our system. So if I just give you an example of that, if you take, and I used this yesterday in terms of Galway University Hospital, if you take them as an example at the minute, they have within their hospitals 15 medical and surgical wards. They have other wards as well for paediatrics and maternity and things, but 15 medical and surgical wards. And of those 15 wards, as we speak, three of those wards are in effect COVID wards for COVID admissions. And they have another four wards that are impacted by COVID, so where they have outbreaks. And important for people to understand that from our perspective, in terms of running a hospital, it runs like a whole system. So we get people in, we treat them, and then hopefully we get them out either to go home, to nursing homes, to specialist rehab, or wherever, obviously with the bulk of them going home. But what that means for us is it hampers our ability to discharge people. So for people who are in wards with outbreaks, they can't go on to nursing homes. They can't go anywhere where they need care until they've gone through a certain period of time. So it affects everything we try and do. We don't have the same freedom to just be able to discharge. And we see that now in terms of numbers of people who are awaiting discharge, for example, to nursing homes or other specialist facilities. So it has a huge impact once you're dealing with that level of COVID in your hospitals.
This weekend marks the centenary of the handover of power from the British government to the new Irish Free State. On the 16th of January 1922, at 1:45 in the afternoon, power was formally handed over and Dublin Castle itself changed hands. To mark the occasion, there'll be a state commemoration at the Upper Castle Yard of Dublin Castle, which the President, the Taoiseach and members of the Defence Forces will attend. Trinity College Dublin is also hosting a two-day conference at the Printworks in Dublin Castle to explore the implications and significance of this momentous event. It's available to the public because it's being streamed live. Well, I'm joined by Anne Dolan, Associate Professor of History in Trinity College. Anne, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat.
Now, first of all, bring us back to what actually happened on the day. Were there soldiers marching in and soldiers marching out, flags being taken down and flags being raised?
No, it was nothing as dramatic as that. And I think Neil Jordan has a lot to answer for in terms of how we perceive this moment. It's actually quite a sort of dull moment in a way. All you see, all the people that gathered outside the castle gates, all they really saw were three taxis going in with the new provisional government. They saw Lord Fitzalan go in his car and they saw four cars come out, and that's pretty much all they saw. There was a very quiet meeting inside. There was a handover of some paper. The new ministers in the provisional government met the heads of the different departments that they were going to take over. So really, it's nothing like the dramatic moment that we've probably been expected to maybe think it should have been. Nothing like maybe some of the more dramatic handovers of later decades. So it's a rather quiet moment, surprisingly so in some ways.
So there were crowds, well, small crowds perhaps, but crowds outside waiting for something dramatic to happen. and they just saw three taxis.
Yeah, I mean, the crowds were apparently quite big. Like, all the newspapers referred to thousands. They referred to the sort of Dame Street being full, Parliament Street, all the streets around the castle entrances. And they just, you know, I think people had gathered, and certainly had gathered with the expectation that something big was to happen, because the newspapers had sort of prepared them that this was a big deal. So there were quite a lot of people there. Some of them apparently tried to rush in with the taxis as they went in. Some got into the yard. But, you know, some of those people stayed till 11 o'clock that night. So there's that real sense of occasion for them, even though they didn't get to see much. You know, there were people there. And certainly this was a moment that was covered, you know, in newspapers from the Skibbereen Eagle to the Times of India and everywhere in between. So I think in some ways it's been overshadowed by, you know, what we know happens next. You know, it's overshadowed by the Civil War.
Of course, the Civil War.
Yeah.
Do we have any in-person accounts of what happened? I mean, who shook hands with whom? The very moment, was it absolutely 1:45 Dublin time as distinct from London time?
Yeah,
what do we know of it?
It should have happened a little bit earlier, because it should have happened before lunch, but Collins was late because, you know, I think he'd been down in Granard at the weekend seeing Kitty Kiernan. There was issues over a possible rail strike, so he's late coming, which again I think tells us a little bit about the informality of this. So there's a little bit of lateness. He's the first in the door. He meets Lord Fitzalan, who's the Viceroy. There's a sort of a formal handover of the treaty so that they sort of accept the terms of the treaty. So there's a little bit of paper being handed over back and forward. And then, I suppose, the different heads of all the different departments. So all those senior civil servants in Dublin Castle who'd been running all the different boards and committees, they come in and effectively meet their new bosses. We have some first-hand accounts from those civil servants, which are very interesting, about their opinions of their new ministers. They talk about them as being very young, with long hair, with poorly dressed. You know, you get these quite dismissive account of them. And you kind of get the feeling that they suddenly realised the extent of the work that was ahead of them.
Britain's Queen Elizabeth has agreed to strip Prince Andrew of his honorary military roles and royal patronages. Buckingham Palace announced the news yesterday, and it comes as Andrew's facing a looming civil sexual assault court case after the judge ruled this week that the case could go ahead. Now, joining me to talk about all of this is royal commentator Jenny Bond. Jenny, good morning.
Good morning.
Now, you have covered many royal adventures, misadventures and scandals over the years. Is this perhaps the biggest one, the most perilous one for the royal family?
I don't think it's perilous for the monarchy. It's deeply unpleasant for the royal family, and the brand is being damaged and has been damaged by this. But I think going back in history, in the 30 years I've been reporting, probably the death of Diana and the aftermath of that possibly was more of a threat to the monarchy itself and to the Queen. In this, though, I think that she's acted fairly swiftly. And I think she and her courtiers would have woken up this morning with a sense of relief, first of all, that certainly over here in Britain, there's been some major news stories. I mean, there's been Djokovic, there's been a Downing Street, another Downing Street scandal, if you like, which has knocked this off the top of the bulletins. They'll be relieved about that. That's a stroke of good fortune. But also, I think they will wake up feeling that they have partially lanced this boil, which Prince Andrew has become, the toxicity is surrounding him, the damage he's doing to the family. And I think that they now have acted to separate the man from the institution of monarchy.
It's okay to do that, but he will still be known as Prince Andrew. And if the case goes ahead, and we'll talk about that in a moment, if the case goes ahead, this is not going to go away, and it will proceed during the Queen's Platinum Jubilee year.
Yep, there's no denying that. He has three courses of action, really. They're all deeply unpalatable to the Prince. One is to fight this out in court. One is to ignore the proceedings, refuse to cooperate, in which case it'll be found against him. And the other is to settle out of court, which is the most likely, but that can only happen if the other side agree. And at the moment, Virginia Giuffre, the woman who has put forward these sex allegations, which the Prince denies categorically, she's indicating she may not be happy to settle out of court. So it is going to drift on through the Platinum Jubilee celebrations, whatever happens.